I think that sometimes as business owners, we miss the importance of building that intimacy. Do you have a connection, right? Like that is invaluable. And it's that intimacy that makes curiosity safe to pursue. Hey, y'all. Welcome back to the Fast Forward Podcast. I am so excited to continue our discussion on world opportunity. And again, I designed this conversation for this month to highlight the fact that there are global opportunities to build the business and the career of your dreams. This conversation is very special to me because it incorporates two of my favorite parts of my own career and business, and that is coaching and the Gallup psychometric assessment. I have been a professional coach for, oh gosh, probably 17 years now. But I always say I've kind of been a coach my whole life because I did a lot of career mentorship as a kid. And then I was a chaplain and spiritual advisor for many years. And a lot of that involved coaching and counseling around career development and business development and all kinds of things. So coaching is near and dear to my heart. And I am completely in love with the Gallup tool and have been since I was introduced to it. I first learned about Gallup as a graduate student many years ago, and it kind of saved my self-image. It helped me to see my strengths at a time when I was at a very low point in my life, and I'm grateful for it. It has only become even more important to me in my professional coaching career. I am a certified Gallup coach, and so this is how I met today's guest, because we were introduced by a former Gallup employee, and then we're also in groups together, and I would see her comments and I'm like, that person looks cool, man. And it's always like, yeah, but they probably would say anything to me. And then when we had the introduction, it was like, here we go, this is serendipitous. So when I knew I was going to talk about global opportunities, I knew that there was no way I could have this conversation without Joe. So with all of that being said, I want to introduce my friend to you all, Joe. Joe, please tell us about yourself and give us a fun fact.
Yeah, well, so I am Joe Self. I am also a Gallup certified coach. And yes, Joe Self is my real name. They do not go together. I cannot tell you the number of emails I get where they're like, dear Joe Self, all one word. And I'm like, no, no, but okay. We'll go with that. I also am often a boy. They add an E to the end of my name. Also not a boy. So another fun fact. I would say that I am a Gallup certified coach. I don't lean very heavily into the coach part, but I had to laugh when you said you feel like you've been a coach your whole life. Because when you said when you got certified, I was like, how long? I was like, I don't know. I feel like I've done that my whole life. Like, I'm the person people have always gone to for advice, that people I think I should be asking them for advice, they're asking me for advice.
Yes. I used to do the adults in my family's resumes at like 11 and 12. And people were like, well, I'm like, no, I literally used to like, anyway, yes.
Yeah, I was Mama Joe in high school. If you needed a hug or advice, you came and found me.
Yes.
Right. And I mean, you went to me before you went to your best friend half the time. Yes. I was like the confessional.
Yes.
And so it's really funny. My girlfriend had asked me one time, and it's one of her favorite questions to ask people, is what did you want to be when you grow up? And I said, you're not going to believe this, but I wanted to be Dr. Doolittle. I was so mad that animals wouldn't talk to me.
Yes.
And I would literally, and it wasn't a Disney princess thing. It was a Dr. Doolittle thing. I wanted animals to feel confident and trust me enough to know that if they wanted to talk, they could talk to me.
Yes.
I wouldn't tell anybody their secrets. Their secret would be safe with me. They didn't need to talk to anybody else. It would be all right with me. That never happened. And she goes, you know, I think you kind of became a Dr. Doolittle for people. And I went, I never really thought about that, but I guess maybe you're right. So maybe I am Dr. Doolittle in another way.
Yes, I love that too, because we all have these hidden parts of ourselves that we've never been able to tap into. And I'm sure you found this even with thinking about the Gallup tool, because a lot of us operate from trying to fight to be something that we're not. We want to fit these boxes. We want to fit into these little, you know, compartments that everybody sets for us. And as a coach and as a mentor, as an advisor, you quite literally get to empower people to say, no, you get to decide who you're going to be today and every day. And here is how that can look. You own plotting the plan, which is so rewarding and so fulfilling.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's probably what led me into branding. And it probably comes from a deeper place, too, because when you said that, like, I lost my mom when I was 11 and I lost my dad when I was 27. So I'd lost my immediate family by the time I was 27. So my grandparents went very quickly around the same time as my dad. And I don't say that as a tragic story. Yes, it's sad, but it was really two things. One, it was sad. There was grief, but it was also paralyzing and liberating at the same time.
Totally understand.
Because all of the sudden, I questioned if the woman I was becoming and trying to be was who I really wanted to be or who I thought they wanted me to be. And I can't even say what they were trying to force me to be, just what I had interpreted that would make them proud. Was I just living something that was about making them proud? Because I suddenly thought, my whole life I'd wanted to be a mom. And I don't know if I wanted to be mom as much as I wanted my dad to be a grandpa. Right? And I was like, wow, God, if I don't have grandparents, do I really want kids?
Wow.
I don't know. Wow. And my son is sitting in the other room right now. He's probably thinking, great, mom, thanks. But, so I have a wonderful son, right? I have a wonderful son. But I will tell you that it really had me question my desire and something that had been a lifelong desire of mine to, do I really want that?
Yes.
Because and I don't know why I do want it,
what would it look like?
Exactly. Exactly.
The title still has an identity that gets shaped around it. And that
I feel like a dad more than a mom because I was raised by my dad. I was raised as an only child by my dad. And so I was raised to be a woman through what my dad believed a woman should be. And so when I parent my son, I never really felt like a mom. I feel like a dad guiding his kid because I think of myself more as the guide, the advice giver. I'm not the boo-boo kisser as much. I'm probably a little more emotional than his actual dad, but like, I'd never felt like I was very stereotypically filling the role of mom.
Yes.
Which I think has a lot to do with, I know we're going to talk about, not today, but what we're going to talk about in the forum.
Yeah.
With you, which will be passed by the time this happens, but that we're going to talk about. And I think there's a really interesting thing with strengths, right? And how it doesn't just help us step into our identity, but I think it also helps us neutralize the stereotypes of who we're supposed to be.
Can you talk more about neutralizing? Because when I hear neutralize, neutralizing something doesn't eliminate its presence.
No.
It simply minimizes its impact until you're ready for it. And I think that is an important distinction because a lot of people feel like, well, if something is still present, and this is about everything from our flaws, our insecurities, I call them sandpaper people, folks who annoy, everything doesn't get removed, right? The absence isn't the goal.
No.
It is the impact and your control over how you engage with that impact that is so important.
Yes. And I would say, you know, speaking as a woman, right, I'm talking about not feeling like a mom. I've worked with people with strengths where dad's the caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
Dad kisses the boo-boos and mom is the one who plans the play dates and like does the social stuff. But God forbid they have to make their kids brush their teeth or like pack their lunch in the morning. But dad's all over it. Well, dad's got discipline. Dad's got empathy. Dad's got all those talents that like make him want to do that. Right. And mom has got the talents that are like, I want to be social and I want to meet the moms and I want to do the birthday parties. And they're like, I don't
or the hardcore, like, you know, get your work done and this is your goal and have you signed up for it and what's going on with the ACT, right? Because maybe mom has strategic or maybe mom has
achiever and competition and who knows, right? And so they feed it and you're and they're like, man, I just don't feel like, you know, the real mom. And I feel like my husband's probably really upset that I'm not doing the mom things. I'm like, but your strengths don't really lend you to doing the mom things. So like when I talk about neutralizing, I talk about I'm thinking of the flow of energy. So I think about the Athena Doctrine. And I don't know if you've seen that TED Talk or read the book, The Athena Doctrine. Personally, and please forgive me, John Gersema, if you ever listen to this, the book is okay. The introduction is where all the meat is. And that's what the TED Talk is about. I love it because it goes through a lot of questions. But in the question of leadership, they took slightly over, I think, I think they took roughly 100,000 people. My numbers are going to be a little bit off, but let's say 100,000 people to make it easy and even. They took a list of words and they gave that list of words, 50,000 of that group, which was a global international top 15 GDP countries around the world, gave them the list of the words and said, identify these adjectives as masculine, feminine, or neutral. And then they took that list of words and to the other 50,000 people, they said, pick out the words that for you describe a great leader. And then they charted them. And wouldn't you know, most of the descriptors that people wanted for their leaders were predominantly feminine words, descriptors. Not all of them, but a significant number of them. And I think that for me is why strengths can be so powerful in leadership, so powerful in a global context, because it gives us a way to see ourselves as a flow of energy and take the biology or the gender expectation out of it and see us for who we really are and where we're going to thrive best, regardless of whatever ism you want to put around that.
Yes, I love that so much. That's so powerful because when we think about the totality of our humanity, because that's what I call it, that is genderless, right? That is, it doesn't even have a box. It is, like you said, a flow. It is a being. And I get to show up in a multitude of ways. And it's interesting because even when you were talking about, I love that you brought up parenting, because first of all, a lot of people, when they think about strengths, they only think about it in terms of work, because that's where a lot of people engage with the tool.
Right. That's where they heard about it.
That's where they heard about it. That's who paid, right, for them to take the assessment.
Right.
And so we don't always get to see how it shows up in other parts of our lives. But I am a, you know, strategic friend. I am a futuristic lover. I am an ideator when it comes to how I communicate with folks in my community. Right. And we get to show up with our strengths fully in every single part of our lives.
Yes.
And I think that that's so important for us to recognize, accept, and then really relish in that.
Yeah.
That is us. It just so happens that the places where a lot of times we can locate outcomes of our strengths is work. Because work in and of itself or school in and of itself is outcome based. So I can easily track when I'm doing something at work or at school because I get a paycheck, a grade, a performance review, right? Like there are literal grades for doing things. I don't get graded on being a parent. I don't get graded on being a friend in that same way.
Yeah, correct. And I would say that while most performance evaluations are deficit driven,
yes.
So,
yep.
Yes, I think our strengths show up. We can see where they are at work. I think because we learn about it at work, we tend to think of it in the context of work. But yes. I also want to say that a lot of our outcome measurements, whether it's school or the boardroom, is often deficit facing.
Yes.
Right. We don't actually recognize what is really brilliant about you. And in the fact that we don't recognize what's brilliant about you, right? I always kind of describe knowing our strengths. Like when you don't know this language, when you don't know the 34 talents, when you don't have that as a filter or a context, it is like asking, I would love, Kaylin, describe yourself to me, what you look like as if you've never looked in a mirror. Would you know how to describe your face? You know, you have a nose, you assume you have two eyes, right? You can kind of feel around, but you don't know how beautiful you are, or that there's a mole on your right cheek, or, you know, whatever it is, right? You don't know that. You don't have the context for it. And then when you learn your talents, you're like, oh, there's the mirror, right? And
yes.
So there's why you are the way you are. And most people, one of my favorite stories to tell is I can remember being in eighth grade and this group of very angry girls surrounding me at my locker. And they looked at me. Why do you smile all the time? What is wrong with you? Are you some kind of an idiot? Are you some kind of fool? No one is that happy all the time. What is wrong with you? And I was just like, I don't know. I'm just happy, I guess. I don't know. And like, I wouldn't say like I was this happy kid, right? I wasn't this like Pollyanna going around everything. Fast forward about 30 years, I guess. Less than that, 20 years. And I find out I have positivity as a talent. Girl, right. I can't not smile, right? Like, I don't know how not to smile. You pass me on the street, I'm going to smile at you. I don't know how not to. It is a reflex action, right? But now I can explain that to people.
See, what you just said is so important because I actually found affirmation for my strengths in the critiques. So what you said about the detriments in your performance reviews, that's how I knew that my strengths were correct. Because just like what you found out where the girls are like, why are you smiling all the time? I was always that person that would get knocked down in performance reviews and performance conversations for, you're so focused on everything we could be doing. You're always critiquing what we're doing and thinking of ways we could improve. We only want to do this. And but why would you only do this one thing?
Strategic.
This is literally, it literally is. I'm like, this is connected to this other thing though. You shouldn't just be doing this. And they'll be like, no, I'm not promoting you. I'm not doing this. You should only focus on this. And I would get so frustrated.
Yep. That is very, very true as well.
The thing is, they were like, you're always coming up with ideas. We only want to do. And I was like, no, it doesn't work like that. So then when I saw ideation in my top five, I was like, oh, duh. Like, yeah, that's me. Right. But, And this is where the combination of the strengths becomes so important because I have command.
Me too.
My top 10. Now, mind you, my top five are all strategic and executing. I don't have any relationship building or any influencing themes until like 7 through 10. So it's all purple and green at first run.
Yeah.
And it made sense. And even the ones that I have, like, they are very kind of like self-focused. Like, I have like learner, you know, relator, which technically relator speaks more on depth and quality versus quantity.
Yes.
So even with that, I'm a fairly self-sustaining person. Like, I don't need a lot of external energy. In fact, it feels like a distraction. So I would get frustrated at work when they would be like, number one, either work directly with this other person and your performance is tied to them. I'm like, no, we're not doing that. But also it was like, I pick a direction.
Yeah.
This is that focus and achiever. I'm going for it. Whether you agree with me or not, once we decide, or if I decide, because it was something that only needed one decision, I'm on that, right? Like, my command and self-assurance is like, you can't convince me otherwise unless you're presenting information. And I used to get,
I sense a lot of try me.
Girl, I'll tell you, I done had
I'll make it happen.
Literally. And it felt like a challenge. Like, oh, so you think I want, okay. All right. Okay. I got something for that.
Yeah.
And the thing is like, it took me one, working in my own business, and two, getting past the trauma of not being accepted for my strengths.
Yeah.
Because there's a part where there is a grieving period where you realize your strengths and you see all the places where those strengths were just like completely refuted, dismissed, you know, sabotaged.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you sit with that grief because of everything that could have happened, whether it is the feeling of belonging, the financial rewards of belonging, right? Like all the things. And then you get to plot your course forward. Because now I know the types of environments that are probably a better fit for me. And so here we go. Let's move forward now. And I think I would compare it like in Lord of the Rings, when it's the start of the Two Towers, right? So everybody loves either the first or the third one usually, but folks hate that second movie, the Two Towers. But the Two Towers is so important for setting up not just the storylines, but also the arc of character development. because there's a point that comes in the Two Towers where they have like a watershed regrouping, refocus moment after they rediscover, right, Gandalf, who is now Gandalf the White. He's not Gandalf the Grey anymore. You know, they got their hands whooped, right, by the Balrog and the first, right, like, they have to get back together.
You just triggered like three different ideas and ways to go in this conversation in my head. I just want you to know that.
But they have to regroup. And when they regroup, everybody now is out of the delusion of who they just knew they would be in this story. Because when they first start out in the Fellowship, it's like, oh, I'm the champion. I'm the this. And it becomes clear, no, so-and-so, you weren't going to make it because you secretly were greedy. And that's why you ended up getting off. Who was that? I was about to say Beowulf. The man whose brother ended up popping up like in the second and third one. But anyway, he got knocked off. Okay, he's out of there. But clearly, we're starting to see that Aragorn is the king. He don't want to be. He like to play like he not. But guess what? He has all the features and the personality traits of that. Hey, guess what? You know, Pippin and Took, y'all goofy. And you need to grow up and mature. Like, stop playing. Because clearly, you were not mature enough for this. Hey, guess what? Sam, you thought that you were just here to just be a sacket, but guess what? You have a level of groundedness and deep loyalty that is needed for this mission. I need you to stick with it. Hey, guess what? You know, like, all of the people get to see who they are. You know, Frodo, hey, guess what? You thought you were just going to go drop the ring off like you running a little errand. No, guess what? This is some real stuff. It's not a game.
Yeah.
And it's about to get realer. So all of these things, I feel like that is a similar grieving period that you go through with your strengths.
Yes, and I think that it's really interesting that you say that, because part of it is where practical strengths for me came from. So, right, I started writing the practical strengths books because our strengths do not go away, right?
No,
now, they certainly can be a double-edged sword. They're not always going to show up as a strength, right? We start with that talent, and we're going to go to the light or we're going to go to the dark. And sometimes the dark is where we find our peace. But it's not what actually works for everybody else. And that's where we get that mask. And that's where we go into these spaces because we don't feel safe. We don't feel accepted. We don't feel valued. And so the tiger side of our strength comes out, right? And so it was really interesting as I started building my community, what led to the first, you know, Future of Strengths Forum was the number of people I had in a really short time tell me, yeah, I took that, but like, I don't really like them and I don't really get it. And like, that feels like everything that's wrong with me. And I was like, oh, that hurts me to my soul. Okay, let's unpack that, right? And we got into the like, how our strengths can actually be a mask for us and how they maybe don't show up. But I also noticed like there was one particular trend with neurodivergence. There was a trend with having some sort of emotional or domestic abuse at home when they were kids. They were often really high and restorative and harmony, right? And what they, you know, so people talk about that nature versus nurture thing. And I think that nature is there, but I do think our environments and how we're raised can certainly shape it. And I think it can shape it because when it's naturally there, for example, my kid came out of the womb competing. I don't have a competitive bone in my body. There is nothing I could have possibly done to nurture that in him if I wanted to, right? So it is there. However, I do have to figure out how to nurture it in the right way, because if it's not, his competing could become very ugly later on for not getting recognized, right? So we tend to, if it's there and it hasn't been valued, we will still find a way to use it. It just may not be in the best way. Right.
Thank you for saying that. Can I make a clarification with that?
Yeah.
Strengths are like boundaries. Boundaries are there for you. They don't control your environment.
Right.
Right. So I am strategic for me. And as a maturing person in my strengths, I've learned I can't express my strategic the same way in every environment because it's not a fit. But I have now gotten to the point where I could create enough environments or environments where I have enough control to where I can thrive in it. And I think that that's the part that we miss, because sometimes we assume that the environment will carve itself to be a fit for our strengths. And that's not how that works.
No, that is not how that works. And in fact, I would say one of the things I think is really important, it's actually a key exercise that I do through my Language of You program. We normally usually start off with a professional, you know, access point to this. And so I do this theme dynamics activity. It's based on something that Gallup does during their certification, but I've, you know, my maximizer maximized it. And so it's great. And we use, you know, nouns and adjectives. So my strategic, I am a map maker in my professional space. If I get to show up in my best way in a professional space, I'm a map maker, right? My activator, you know, is ready to initiate. My maximizer is results oriented. My, you know, communication is perceptive, like, right? And so I, or interactive and right. And then my ideation is perceptive. And so all of those meld to how I help people with their branding or understanding how to market themselves or understanding how they show up in the world is creating that. You can take that same exercise and put on a different hat. So when I do that same exercise, my strategic as a mom becomes an explorer. My adjectives change, right? And when I look at it as a friend, then I become the planner. I'm the coordinator, right? And so our strengths are always going to be there, and really understanding how they can shift and play into each of our environments at their best is such a beautiful exercise, because I've done it a couple of times where one person had really high analytical, and when she did it as a mom, she went, oh, I do not like how my analytical shows up as a mom. She's like, my kids are grown. She's like, but I got to change this. This is work. This isn't what I should be doing with my kids with analytical. And so seeing that on paper helped her figure out, okay, what adjectives do I want? How do I want to shape my analytical so it works out? And then I had somebody else who was like, I really like my word for, and it was for connectedness. And she said, I really like how I show up for connectedness in my personal life, but I don't feel like it's really what I do in my professional life. And I'm like, I said, it's going to be a semantic thing. And I said, are you very like kind of spiritual and, you know, intuitive and that kind of thing? And it, maybe even a little woo woo, you think? And she's like, yes. And I said, because she used philosophical for her work descriptor, but she used spiritual for her self descriptor. And I was like, what if you could be both? What if you could be the one you most love in both spaces? What would it take to give yourself permission to do that? What would that look like? And I understand that struggle because I did the same thing. And I think a lot of it was my connectedness was like my woo-woo side. How do I bring that into my professional life?
Yeah.
And I finally saw a link, like a quote from Brené Brown that was this huge liberation when I can be both of those things. It is okay. And I don't have
you're
to shout it from the screen.
To be both.
Right. I don't have to shout it from the rooftops, but to let people understand that there is a space for both of those things to exist.
Yes.
And it's okay is a beautiful thing.
I don't think we give ourselves permission to be multifaceted because it feels like masking. And so, and I think this is a really good way to connect our conversation about global opportunities, because who I have to be. So again, I'm always Caitlin.
Yeah.
But there are environments where I go where I'm a newbie, where I am quite literally a foreigner, where I have much less cultural knowledge, cultural capital, cultural authority. Mm-hmm. And when I go into those environments, guess what? I'm still Caitlin, who has strategic achiever, you know, ideation, futuristic, and focus. But sometimes I have to turn those things inward before I express it outwardly. Because what in the United States feels like, well, why didn't she speak up in the meeting? She just sat there quiet and didn't say anything. And another culture might be, oh my goodness, that person just took over the conversation, right?
Exactly.
And I had an experience at a business development conference in Turkey, and there were representatives from several European countries. And there was one person in particular from one country. We got super cool. Like, we were talking in the like little round tables with them. It was an evening reception and we were talking, and I went just without even thinking. I was like, yeah, because I'm going to succeed in this market. Like, there's no way I'm not going to do it. And he cracked up and he said, you are such an American. And I laughed because I was like, dang, that is like a very American thing where it's like, I'm going to come over here and do this. And it's like, girl, sit down. You know what I mean? Like, no,
we need to have a talk.
Yes. And even if you felt that way, like, you'll say that out loud, but it was just funny because that was one of my aha moments where I realized that, like, okay, girl, the expectation is that you're gonna, like, kind of throw your weight or, you know, put your intentions out there.
Yeah.
Because especially in, think about gender, male-oriented business environments, like, you need that kind of, like, braggadocious, almost like machismo to even exist in certain rooms.
Yes.
Especially around sales. But guess what? No. Not just because it's an evening reception, but because that's not the tone of how you do that here. And that level of cultural humility has been very important for me to learn.
Yes.
And it almost, I had to go back to the level of newness that I experienced when I first went to undergrad. So I grew up in Detroit, and we've talked about this.
Mm-hmm.
Grew up in Detroit. And Detroit is, like, all Black. So, like, I've been around Black people my whole life. When I went to Michigan, I mean, it was, like, real cultural shock. And there were also some other sociological things happening around, like, the affirmative action decision, and just the campus was very, it was hot. It was, there was a lot going on and a lot to navigate socially and politically. But I remember feeling kind of like a fish out of water, where it was like, oh, I'm not the center of this universe.
Yeah.
Like, I am different. I am the other now. And I'd have no basis for even knowing how to navigate these environments. How do I thrive here? And I did not necessarily do it well for a while and eventually learned how to figure it out. But I had that same aha moment over the past couple years, because I traveled to many different regions to do business development. So even certain things that, you know, I learned were acceptable, let's say in Turkey or Central Asia, when I go to South America, it's not, or when I go to Canada, it's not, right? Like, so there are a lot of things that are happening, and it can be difficult to navigate if you're not willing to be humble enough to learn.
Which is where I like the strengths as a language piece of it.
Yes. Yep.
Because, you know, I lived overseas for the last 14 years. I've only recently come back to the U.S. I left in 2010 and I lived in Uruguay for a few months. And then I moved to Peru, where I was for 11 years, got my dual citizenship there, and then moved to Mexico City for almost 3 years before moving back here. And I won't say there's a reverse culture shock, but there has definitely been a, like, woo, okay, yeah, that's really American, right? Like that. But it's also funny because I've often said that in Peru, I felt like I had to live in my bottom five all the time. Like, I did not feel like I really got to express my talents very openly, because what comes so naturally for me was not particularly valued or desired.
Yeah.
And it's funny because people are like, oh, but they love working with foreigners. They'd rather work with a foreigner than another Peruvian. And you heard it all the time. And to some degree, that is true. They will trust foreigners before they trust one of their own, often in Peru. But I like to smile a lot. And you don't smile at people on the street. There's a real, what's she want? What's her angle?
Yeah.
Right. You don't, you can do that with your friends, but it's what I would call maybe a relator society, right? Like, they're very comfortable in their family and their bubbles with the friends they've had since elementary school. And it's really hard to penetrate those circles. And if you don't have a family or a spouse or friends that help you penetrate, you're almost never going to go in. But you also have to determine which circle you want to be in, because gosh forbid you pick this circle and you want to go to this circle, because these two circles,
Joe, that's how it is in the South. I, born, raised in the Midwest, lived then in Chicago for a while, then lived in New York. So it was like East Coast for some years and then West Coast for a little bit.
So I've got Boston, Chicago, Michigan. Yeah.
Yes. Like, girl, the South is a totally different animal. Like, and I was talking to another friend slash colleague about this recently, and they were describing their experience, like, in high school transitioning down here, and how difficult it was because there is a social hierarchy that gets set up very young.
Yes.
And you trying to come in as an adult to penetrate, I mean, you better have, you need a chaperone. I put it like that. You need a chaperone to get in.
I went to Albion. I went to liberal arts, Albion, yep. Small private yep. liberal arts school right here in Michigan, right down the road yep. from you at Michigan. And I transferred to Nacogdoches, Texas, to Stephen F. Austin State University, where everybody was known. If the girls were there, they were there to get their MRS degree. I mean, that's what they were told, right? I mean, like, it was there for teachers and, like, maybe nurses. Like, that's all girls were allowed to do. I went from co-ed hallways to curfew in single-sex dorms. And I was just like, what is this? I have never, it was such, and I made very good friends. I actually had a really wonderful time, but oh my gosh, I could not believe
yes.
how different it was.
Yes.
Just from Michigan to Texas. Like, I did not think I would expect that kind of culture shock.
It's totally right? different.
It was crazy.
And the interesting part is that I'm learning that there are parts of me that I'm picking up or that are evolving that I like. And then it becomes almost like a buffet. And I never would have imagined that. I think now looking back, and I'm sure you had this experience too, like after you live and work so many different places, you have a buffet of traits, of ways of yeah. showing up in the world that you can pick and that you can reject. And I think it's important for people to know that that evolution is possible. And it, especially as a coach, that you get to, because coaching in a way is kind of like a chameleon, right? Like you have a self, you have a way you show up.
Yes.
But you also have ways that you choose to blend into environments, even if it is to get an understanding. And we don't always prepare ourselves for that.
No, and I think it's really important what you just said, because that ability to be a chameleon, there is some power in that. But I also believe, you know, one of the things I do when I work with coaches is who are you as a coach, which is one of the reasons I say I'm not a coach, because my talents don't let me keep my opinions to myself. So like, I'm never going to go for an ICF certification because it is going to kill the person I am. That does not mean I don't value the ICF certification. It doesn't mean that I don't think it's an amazing thing for other people. I think it's beautiful. It is not for me. Right? And I think some people are kind of scared to say things like that. But
yes, because ICF, by the way, I'm ICF certified and I'm an ICF coach educator. So I totally understand what Joe is saying, because there is a very like set prescribed methodology, and that
there's
is
a methodology and you have it to is. Do that, and it's very yep. rigorous, and I mean, and it's very reputable. That is, this is not a dig at ICF at mm-hmm. all.
Nope.
But discipline is like 30 for me.
Right.
Right. Like you're gonna put me in a box and I have to do that, and then I have to get these hours and I have to check things in. Like I can't balance yeah. my checkbook. Like,
yeah.
I'm not gonna be able to log hours and keep I'm just not gonna nah. do it. And I like to advise. So if I go to the Standout, which I love Standout by Marcus Buckingham, I'm a pioneer advisor. When I read the description for advisor, it practically made me cry, because I'm like, yes, that's yeah. what I love to do.
Yes.
And try to get that out there. And I think that's similar with, you know, when we talk about the cultural traits and we think about who we want to coach.
Yeah.
I would never presume to be an excellent coach for Black women, because while I can relate to the woman side potentially, I don't have the cultural background, the historical background, the context. I can certainly help you in certain spaces, but I would never try to make that my zone of expertise, right? Because that's not what I know. And so that's why I'm expanding Practical Strengths and building the bench like I'm building it, with global partners and with regional partners and people that are very good at HR. Could I go in and work with an HR team? Probably. Am I really the person you want to do that? Or do you want the person who has like 30 years of HR experience behind them and loves strengths and has this methodology? No, I'd pick that person. So I want that person on my team so that we can be exactly who we need to be for the people who need us most.
Yes, that's so important, because what I heard and what you just said is there is a difference between a consultant, an advisor, a coach, a mentor, right? And then what I would say, because I'm an organizational psychologist, so mm-hmm. the work that I do is an organizational psychologist. And yeah. then sixth, an in-house HR professional or L&D professional, right?
Yeah.
Those six identities are quite distinct. And sometimes you might play multiple roles. I mean, there are times where I'm all six, right? But then there are times where I have to sit in my one identity. And so even from just like a business development standpoint, I want to say this to the folks who will listen, whether you're a coach or one of the other six that I described. Be very clear and distinct in how you set up your service packages, how you set up your team, how you build your business, how you build your marketing and branding structure so that you have clear delineations between them. Because yes. Number one, when you try to play too many things without that distinction, you create some legal vulnerabilities in your company, right?
Yes.
Because you need, in some cases, different insurances, depending on what you're doing.
Right.
And you may need different credentials, different training, because while Joe just said she's not interested in getting the credential, please listen to what she said when she says she still trains herself. She's mentioned like 5 books. She reads, she educates herself on methodologies and tools to build her knowledge base. So credentialing and knowledge is not the same thing. We should all be doing self-improvement. I had to say that part. But also the third aspect to think about from a business development standpoint is that our work is still quite abstract to most people. Like, we get it and we understand it,
yeah.
But to the potential clients and customers you're pitching to, having that delineation will help you use marketing language that helps them know what they're buying. So it's not only an integrity issue, but it can also help boost your sales, because some people are looking for more advisor than coach. Some people are looking for more coach than consultant. Some people are looking for an organizational psychologist perspective or lens to come in and do the work, right? And not in-house professional. And sometimes they're looking for someone who is an external person to partner in-house. So again, understand your distinction and how you're positioning yourself, because that will help. Last thing I'm going to say with that, when you think about from a global lens, right? Different parts of the world have different levels of comfort with non-native folks playing any of those six roles.
Correct.
So just like how Joe described how she chooses to show up for Black women, because she recognizes the limitations of her own lived experience. In some cases, there will be countries that you will try to penetrate where you won't be accepted as in-house counsel. You might not be able to get an in-house job in that country doing that, but you could potentially be an advisor to a consulting firm that is, right? So you can collaborate.
Yes.
You may be able to have a global coaching practice where you see folks remotely, but you would not be able to go to that country in person and be sitting down meeting with them for any number of reasons.
Right.
So you have to educate yourself from that business development lens as a professional to know, the opportunities, but also the limitations.
Right.
Very
because
important.
Depending on what you're doing, and it's funny because, you know, I got started my journey with Gallup. At the very least, which I've been a, you know, Gallup certified for 10 years, I really became a personal branding and business strategy coach for other coaches. 80% of my clients were other coaches, which was not at all what I was trying to do. In fact, I didn't even think, who am I to be a strengths coach to other strengths coaches? Like, that's goofy. But it wasn't the strengths that brought it to it. It was because I created this personal branding thing. And I wanted to work with entrepreneurs. I wanted to work with service-based entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, people who deserved a chance to be successful without getting charged an arm and a leg and maxing out their credit cards and everything else. And I'd already been an entrepreneur for 10 years at that point, you know, so I wanted a me for me, right? That's what really drove me to do what I did. And as I get more into strengths, I see it as a language. I think it's 34 words that unite 8 billion people on this planet. Can I coach all 8 billion of those people? No, thank you. Like, should I? No, definitely not. Can I? Absolutely not. So that's where I build those partnerships, right? But giving people tools to do that. So when the Practical Strengths book came out, like, you can see my little books right there, kind of, right? That last one right there, that's kind of colorful, is the 8 Elephants book. That is
love it.
A guide and workbook for service-based entrepreneurs who are trying to figure out what they need to do. It's the 8 Elephants to Succeed in Business One Bite at a Time.
Wow.
And honestly, you can apply it wherever you are, because it's not tied to like what is American. But often when I'm coaching, because I've coached clients in probably 30 different countries and on every continent except Antarctica. And
that's
I will amazing. Often say, I don't know if this will work in your culture, but this is how I would have done it. Is there something like that you can do? And right, we talk through it and what they could do. And then we coach to that because I ask the questions because I recognize that I'm limited on some of that. But now I have a partner in Saudi Arabia and I have a partner in Brazil. And I'm hopefully picking up a partner right now from Mexico and LATAM. And granted, I have experience in LATAM and that is a space that I feel pretty comfortable in. I also still know my limitations in that space. But
absolutely.
These books, the Practical Strengths books, they're written to be very practical for anyone. I am fully aware that I write it from my, I don't want to say a narrow viewpoint of being an American, but that is my culture and what I was raised in, even though I've had a lot of overseas experience.
Yeah. Any individual is narrow because you're only limited to one of 8 billion perspectives. So that's natural.
Right, right. So when I went to translate these books, so these partners that I have, the book is currently actively and has been translated into, but not published yet. Chinese, Arabic, and Portuguese is about to come out. The deal with translating the book. So translation. So if anybody wants to like translate some strength stuff and wants to become a partner, that's an opportunity. What I did with that, what's really important to me is it's basically a glossary for how you apply your strengths. The first book was on parenting. The second was on career success. The third one's on communication styles. Conflict management is coming out next, and then relationships, and then a family and education, which is like an update of the parenting one because the parenting was first and didn't have the structure. But so I've got like, there's probably 12 books in this series. It's going to happen eventually, but they're just practical application, very layman's terms. Accessible prices. When I translated them, I wanted all 34 strengths because they each have an anecdote of a personal experience of how that strength plays out in parenting. So you have Achiever as a parent. How does that work out? So everything has a personal anecdote. So when I went to translate it, I wanted every single one of those strengths to have a new anecdote that was culturally relevant for wherever it is being translated.
Love that.
I refuse to let it. And my partner in Saudi Arabia, I'm going to tell you, he has self-assurance. He has competition. He has significance. He has achiever. He's a powerful person. And I love him, right? I've got command. I can stand my ground, right? And I've got a lot of influencing, but I have the other influencing. I'm the same one he has, right?
Because we're too fast to influence.
Yeah, I got woo. I've got activator. Command is where I can stand in there. But it's really funny. But we were talking and he goes, but Joe, isn't this supposed to be a global movement? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, then I don't think we should take all of the anecdotes out. He said, because I think some of those, because my anecdotes were never just American. I've got anecdotes from people in South Africa, from people in Latin America, from people in Romania. Like it's an international anecdote. But I still need it to be culturally relevant to speak to the audience that's going to be reading it in their own language. And so he's the one who made me think about it. My little maximizer went, all right. So we're going to be very specific about which ones we keep, but at least 11. So at least a third of those anecdotes have to be specifically culturally relevant.
Love that. And I love the intentionality of that. I also want to bring that up as a point to any service-based entrepreneur, because I think sometimes we get so married to what we create. I mean, we're knowledge economists. So our IP, what we create, our ideas, our frameworks are everything to us. However, it is important to remember that just like some products are modified for particular areas, genders, they're accessible for different disabilities, we can and should do that too. And if we're so married to the specificity of one particular idea, book, framework, concept, we can make ourselves obsolete in the market. And as much as you're married to the heart of an idea, be open and adaptable to the way the execution looks.
Yes.
That is how you create services and even products like courses or books that last the test of time, last across cultures.
Well, and so the Practical Strengths Global Partners, when they come on, I mean, the whole purpose for that is that they then write the foreword. They rewrite a new foreword for the book of why they think it's important for their culture to read this book, why they think this is the vision people need, because I'm trying to help them build their business, right? I'm giving them the foundation, the platform, the tools, and then they get to translate and culturally adapt it in the way that they see that it is going to work, because I can't do that. And that does frustrate me, because I know a lot of times we get things that are translated, and I won't call out any one particular company at the moment, but lots of companies who are American based will translate things and they think they've translated it really well. And then you're reading it. And because I speak Spanish, I read stuff that's been translated in Spanish and I go, okay, I understand that because I know English, but like, that's not how you say that. That's not what that really means. Yep. And like, and you get Spanish people looking at you like, what are they trying to say here? And I'm like, okay, I can explain it to you because I know what they're trying to say, but I understand that that is not how you say it. Right. And they're like, that's fine. And I'm like, it's not fine. It's not fine. It's really, I don't know if it's because, you know, the ROI isn't there. I can't tell you how many times I've heard things like the ROI isn't there. And that,
and it has,
there
to
is not
be
a phrase because, that will bother me more than
yes.
Between my maximizer and my connectedness, do not ever tell me there's
well,
no
because
ROI.
People think ROI is simply dollars and cents. And it's like, no, ROI is the feeling of being seen. Like that is return as well. So it's just like when people randomly use AAVE or again, regional slang. Like now with the internet and social media, everybody is creating this mishmash of regional stuff or recipes, and folks push back all the time. Like, no, that is not authentic. Authenticity matters. And as a part of authenticity, it's the how to, it's the flow, it's the cadence. It is the inflection. It is the sequencing of even a joke. All of those things matter. And when you tell someone, only the actual words on the page are what we're going to invest in, you essentially tell somebody, I'm only willing to invest in like 20% of you. And that's just not okay. It's not okay. Well, okay. No. Final question for you.
Yes.
Okay. Because I want to ask, but I want to say this, because especially the conversations around cultural humility, the expression of strength, how you build your business to be culturally humble. So many Americans now are obviously thinking about how to do business in other countries. You know, the geopolitical climate is just like, it is turbulent. And folks are scared, though. Right. So a lot of times when I go to other countries, I am either the only woman, the only Black person, or the only Black woman. Like, if it's five of us total out of hundreds of people, I'm shocked. Right. And I want to know from your perspective, right, as a woman who has lived in other countries, as a woman who has a global business, mm-hmm. how can American business owners build the confidence that they need to expand their business beyond the U.S. border?
Oh, I think the biggest thing to building beyond what you know, and in this case, we're going to call it the borders, the culture that we know here,
mm-hmm.
is to be willing to be a learner, to be willing to ask questions, to be willing to make a mistake, to be willing to say the wrong thing, but humbly accept it and go, oh crap, I'm so sorry. I did not mean to say that. Thank you for teaching me. Thank you for showing me. I think gratitude goes a long way. I think most people, if you can go out there in the world, laws, tariffs, right? We get into a lot of that, but culturally, I think humility and vulnerability can get you so far. And it doesn't mean self-deprecation, and it doesn't mean beating yourself down, and it doesn't mean you're weak when you're vulnerable. It is, I know what I know, and that's great, but I also know what I don't know, and I need you to help me fill in that blank. And when you ask people for help, I would say 9.9 times out of 10, they want to help you.
Yes, they do.
And they are more than happy to do that. It's inclusive. It shows value. It shows you're willing to learn. And I'm stunned because I will say, like, even in leadership, you know, coaching and things that I do, so often I'll, you know, they'll say, but how do we talk to these people? I'm like, them. And they're like, how do I know what they're thinking? Ask them. And they're like, but what do I ask? And I'm like, how about, what are you thinking? I mean, like, let's start there. And I, you know, and I think, I will say that I think a lot of that comes from A, okay, I have woo and communication and ideation. I can probably think of 100 ways to like connect with you if I wanted to with strategic. So not everybody has that gift of being able to do that, right? But also, I think we're so afraid of saying the wrong thing anymore.
Yes, that we won't say
that
anything.
That we say nothing. And I know when I've even had conversations with you and when I've talked to and I've been, you know, because the forum, which is going to be happening in Texas, actually in person in April. But the forum is for me about lifting up diverse voices. And God, I feel like terms change all the time. So I'm like, if I say Black coaches, is that okay? Or am I supposed to say BIPOC? Or what do I say now? And I'll be like, Kayla, what do I say? Just tell me what to say so I don't literally offend anybody. Like, and then I don't want someone to get offended that I asked you because you should know better. Like, I don't know better. And that's why I'm asking. We have killed curiosity. Mm-hmm. Curiosity needs to be allowed to come back.
Yes. And
sorry, long-winded curiosity, answer.
No, I love this because where curiosity thrives is in intimacy. I tell people all the time, like over the past year and a half, I've actually gotten very quiet on social media. I still post because people probably gonna laugh when they hear me say that. Like, girl, you post like 3-4 times a week. No, I schedule them. I do batch stuff. So like most of the time, they ain't me saying stuff every day. But I do very little talking publicly about controversial things. And I do that because over the past 2 years in particular for my business, I have built a network of real relationships where when I have something to share or I don't know something or I have a perspective, I can go to my intimate colleagues, friends, companions, my network, my loved ones, and have conversations to learn, be seen, and grow. And I don't have to subject myself to what sometimes feels like a humiliation ritual. Yeah. And I think that sometimes as business owners, we miss the importance of building that intimacy. Because to be honest, if there were certain things that I wanted to know, I probably wouldn't put a call out on LinkedIn. I would probably email you, Joe, and say, hey, I'm actually looking to expand more in South America, but I really don't know how to touch such and such market. Do you have a connection? Right. Like that is invaluable. Yep. And it's that intimacy that makes curiosity safe to pursue.
Yes.
That's the part.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. So that's a good part in thought. And we have a ton of nuggets for y'all who are listening to this. But one of the biggest ones is that curiosity is safe in intimacy. And if you don't take away anything else we've said today, but that, recognize that you are safe to be curious in places where you have built and nurtured intimacy. Right.
Excellent. Thank you.
On that note, Joe, thank you so much for being here and sharing space with me today. I truly appreciate you. I knew she was going to be awesome, y'all. So I was like really looking forward to this. Of course, if you have a comment or a question for Joe about anything, drop it down in the comments. Let us know what you think. If you're a coach, what are some of the things you're experiencing with your global business development journey? And of course, be sure to like, share, and subscribe. And I will catch you all in the next one. Bye.